The story of the deliverance of the Jews from Egypt. The Jews languish in Egyptian bondage. The newborn are under a sentence of death. If they should be male, there seems to be no hope. And yet within a generation numbers 40 years according to the biblical chronology, the newborn will not only be delivered, redeemed, but they will be standing at the gates of the promised land, a bright new future opening before them. Now, in the ancient world, based as it was on slave economy, slaves were simply not allowed to escape and make good their escape. If one or two broke loose, he was ruthlessly tracked down. Yet somehow this escape was successful. Our fathers ascribed it to God's miraculous power to save. Perhaps that's the best explanation of all. But whatever the reason, it suggests to us that if we would be prophets, if we would predict our future, anyone's future, we must recognize that prophecy and long-range prediction and planning are chancy, what President Roosevelt would have called iffy, undertakings. But if they are iffy, if it is chancy to play the role of the prophet, it is nonetheless of some benefit. It is not totally pointless. Of all those who were in Egypt, only two, Joshua and Caleb, were deemed to have sufficient steadiness of will and sturdiness of purpose to be allowed to undertake the rigors of the conquest. Men cannot jump out of their skins. We cannot change our psyche. We are, in a sense, what our conditioning has made us be, and we cannot undo that conditioning, nor do we really change the institutions which are the extended shadow of what we are, and cast a lengthy shadow over our future. A great deal of what American Jewish life will be like a generation from now, for those of us who are still here, and for those who will be here, has already been set by our nature, what we are, the kinds of people, the kinds of conditioning we have received. And though none of us could predict the climactic events which will twist history, all of us can feel with some degree of confidence that certain of the shadows of tomorrow are suggested by the substance, the reality of today. Which is to say that if we had tried to predict the future for Jews in 1933, a generation ago, 40 years ago, none of us would have predicted the Holocaust. Hitler had risen to power. And we would have expected some pogroms in Germany and perhaps even the Nuremberg laws, but certainly not Dachau. And if we had looked at Palestine in 1933, we might have predicted that it would eventually grow into a Jewish national home, but not certainly that in 15 years there would be a sovereign Jewish state. There were only 175,000 Jews in 1933 in all of the Yishuv. And the year before, only 5,000 Jews had immigrated into Palestine, and almost 1,000 had emigrated from the harsh economic pioneering conditions of that country. None of us then, if we had been tried to have been prophets, would have predicted that this year, 1972, World Jewry would be celebrating the 25th anniversary of a small but strong and successful Jewish state. Nevertheless, I'd like to suggest to you this morning that despite the very marked impact of the Holocaust and of Israel on American Jewish life, an impact which can be seen in the strengthening of our institutions, in the very concept of a Jewish community which has emerged among us, in the raising of the levels of giving to Jewish causes which have been raised by geometric proportions in the last four decades. I'd like to suggest to you this morning that by 1933, the limits of possibility for American Jewish life had already been determined. That much of what we are could already be foreseen, even as I would suggest that much of what we will be 40 years from now can, in a sense, be predicted. By 1933, then, I would suggest to you that it was clear that American Jewish life would remain the life of a small minority of Jews who would be to a certain degree dependent upon the political favor of the culture, the environment in which they found themselves. That this was, in a sense, not a radically new Jewish condition, but the old-fashioned European diaspora. And that this condition had been determined by the racist immigration laws of 1924. When the ability of Jews to enter America was restricted, when the decision of the 1920 Congresses became clear that America was to retain as far as possible its Western, Anglo-Saxon, Nordic cast, this was to be the dominant theme in American life. Eastern Europeans, Slavs, Jews, Orientals, these simply were not wanted. It was clear that we would remain a small minority with limited political power. And if you want to test this thesis, I'd remind you of the two attempts we made after 1924 to increase in some substantive way the number of Jews in these United States. During the 1930s, under the pressure of Hitler, fearing something like the Holocaust, American Jews moved heaven and earth and tried to move what was deemed by them to be a sensitive and responsive administration to allow more than the quota to enter these United States. And what happened? There was a refugee conference at Bermuda. There was another refugee conference at Evian. There was a form of political minuet, a set political diplomatic dance where everyone spoke his piece in order to give the appearance of concern without the reality, without any change in England's or the United States immigration procedures. Yes, a few more trickled in than might have come otherwise, but only a few. America, which numbered then in about 125 million, was simply not willing to bring in 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 Jews to these shores. We tried, we lacked the political power to achieve the end, and the American Jewish community was in this purpose defeated. And I remind you again that at the end of the Second World War, when about 2 million survivors of the concentration camps still languished in displaced person camps in Europe, America made no attempt to open our doors, to undo the quotas as far as these Jews, to let any substantial number of them into these United States. You remember Ernest Bevin, the anti-Zionist and perhaps anti-Semitic labor minister of foreign affairs in Clement Attlee's labor government? You remember how in 1947 he suggested that President Truman's eagerness to have the British allow 100,000 displaced Jews into Palestine was motivated by the fact that he did not want 100,000 Jews, displaced Jews in New York City? There's more truth than we care to admit to this rather realistic and calculated political assessment. We did not get any substantial number of Jewish refugees into these United States in 1946 and 1947. And whatever valuable role President Truman played insofar as attempting to get more Jews into the Promised Land, and as far as the recognition of the new state in 1948, when it came to the domestic concerns of America, the barriers were still up. We have very limited political power. And if you want to Suggest to yourselves the limits of that power. Ask yourselves what would happen if the Soviet Union today would announce that she did not want any longer to restrain those of her Jewish citizens who wanted to emigrate. That of the 300,000 who have decided they would like to leave, she will allow them to leave with one proviso. They may not go to Israel. She is unwilling to allow them to go to a place where they can be part of the military potential of a government which is inimical to the Soviet Union's friends, the Arab states. She will allow them to go if America will let them in. How many do you think any American administration would allow into these United States? A trickle, certainly. 300,000? I wonder. I'm suggesting to you then that America is galut. America is the diaspora. America is a condition of Jewish life unusual in the respect that we came here to a pioneering land which had need for people, unusual in the respect that the laws of this country are as fundamentally concerned with the equality of human rights as the laws of any state the world has ever known. But at the same time, we were 4% of the population in 1933, a generation ago, about 5 million out of 125 million. And today, because of our middle-class birth rates, because of our tolerance of out-marriage, because of the immigration laws, we're about 3% of the entire population. Maybe 6.5 million out of slightly over 200 million. There's been a mystique among American Jews, a mystique about Jewish power. We've mistaken our own ability to advance in an expanding America with the reality of the power of the Jewish group. America has been remarkably kind to this generation of Jews. No other generation in Jewish history have had as great an opportunity. But what is given can be taken back. And we would not be as concerned with numbers. Numbers have never been the determination of the success of Jewish life if it were not for the fact that numbers are beginning to count in the American political system. Whereas in the 40s, in the 50s, in the early 60s, we thought of America largely as a country where there was opportunity, and there was concern with providing the equality of training, of education, of learning, of opportunity, but where each individual would be judged on his own merit. Now, because of the difficulty of coming to grips with a number of the deep racial problems in America, and the deep-set problems of social justice, another concept has been evolved. And this concept deals with numbers, with quotas, with preferential treatment, with what's called affirmative action. Now, none of the affirmative action programs have yet defined the Jew as a minority for which more must be done. But any number of school administrators and medical school deans and administrators of welfare projects and of housing projects have begun to define the Jews as an overrepresented minority. We're only 3%. Look at our numbers in the highly intellectual professions. Look at our numbers in the academic world. And if you're going to begin to label people by groups, then you're going to begin to restrict the opportunity of the next generation of Jews to follow their parents into these occupations. And we have a very paradoxical situation in the United States. Any number of young, middle-aged Jewish men and women who have made it here in America are among those who are most eager to see established some kind of quota system because they can't believe that America is not different. The Jews haven't made it to the point where we can be concerned with everybody else's social needs but our own. And they don't recognize that though their children may not concern themselves with being Jewish, they'll be labeled that way on a piece of paper, on numbers, in quotas. And the very opportunities which have allowed their parents to feel that the old labels, the old restrictions, the old divisions of the old world no longer apply here in the new world are going to restrict and hobble their children in terms of admissions to professional schools, in terms of ability to get certain kinds of government and judicial jobs, in terms of other kinds of areas of American life where the quota system will inevitably become the administrative practice of the land. Unfortunately, in America, like it or not, numbers will count, and Jewish numbers will count against us. Which means simply this, that one of the favorite pastimes of American Jews, which is a kind of prophetic mean of social concern for all other causes but their own, is going to have to be, to a degree, dropped and mitigated for a very involved concern, a very sensitive concern to our own needs. The handwriting is already on the wall. I give you New York State. I give you rather New York City. There are some 400,000 Jews, many elderly, whose incomes qualify them as candidates for poor relief. They fall below the poverty line. Now, the other minorities, the labeled minorities, the authorized minorities in American life, had so structured the elections to poverty boards in New York City, they were always held on the Sabbath or on a major Jewish holiday, which meant, in effect, that most of the poor Jews, who are among the most observant Jews in America, were not able to vote. They had no representation. When it came to the division of what the government offers, they were not there to see to it that they got their own. And it took numbers, Jewish power in New York, if you will, with the state assembly, the government in Albany, to pass a law through the last New York State legislature requiring that elections to the poverty board in New York City be held on some day other than the Sabbath. That's why we must be concerned with Jewish interest, Jewish power, if you will. On the other hand, when the University of Wisconsin 3 years ago announced that in admissions it would no longer take out-of-state students who came from the New York, New Jersey area, read Jews, unless they were the children of alumni of the university, someone, probably a Jew from one of the towns of Wisconsin, introduced a bill into the state legislature to prohibit the Board of Regents of the state university from enacting this kind of discriminatory admissions policy. And that bill failed. There's simply not enough Jews in the state of Wisconsin to coerce gently the legislators of that state to be concerned with a quota policy which operates against Jews. Which is to say that in many ways, sometimes with very seemingly good intentions, Jewish opportunity may be restricted in these United States. Which is to say that over the next generation, American Jews are going to have to be vigilant about their own specific, selfish, if you will, needs to a degree they've not had to be in the last 40 years. Yes, we've been concerned with American reactions to Soviet anti-Semitism. We've been concerned with American involvement in the Middle East and her special relationship with the State of Israel. But as American Jews over the last generation, we've not really had to be concerned with our own domestic Jewish interests. And that's where I feel the crunch is going to come in the next generation. And we're only diffidently and to a certain degree unwillingly beginning to move into this area. If you want to see where we are, I give you Forest Hills in New York City. Part of Mayor Lindsay's program for public housing displaced in other than poor areas of the city. There are any number of these scattered house public housing sites selected. When the black community in an area of New York called Bexley Park objected to the impact on the area of the project which had been drawn up, there'd be too many people brought in, too many poor, too many new social problems, the problems of their children on the street, the problems of deprived children in their schools, etc., etc., etc. They went to the NAACP, and the NAACP went with the local residents to Mayor Lindsay, and that project was aborted then and there. But when the Jews of Forest Hills came with the same set of concerns to the American Jewish Committee, and to the American Jewish Congress, the national defense organizations, which are headquartered in New York City. What happened when they came to the offices of those who work in the city but who live in the rather white suburbs of Scarsdale in New Jersey? They were lectured to about Americanism, about social justice, about someone having to pay the price of change, and they were told to go home and go to shul on Yom Kippur. No help was offered to them. And we had 3 years of local protest and demonstration before finally certain changes were made in that program in the mayor's office. The project was cut in size. What I'm suggesting by this illustration is simply that our community organizations, and particularly our national organizations, are not yet geared up to be instinctively sensitive to the problems of the Jewish poor, to the problems of the lower middle class Jew who can't simply pick up and move from neighborhood to neighborhood, to the problems of the Jew in a community who cannot afford to pick his child out of a public school system and put him in a private school system when that system begins to go under the impact of the deprived. And whether or not we develop this level of concern in the next generation, I think will determine to a great degree whether we have a Jewish community at the end of the next generation. If our Jewish community still revolves around the rich and those who like to be with the rich, those who can afford to give big sums of money, to be myopic as far as the needs of the ordinary, the Pruster Yid, the ordinary Jew is concerned, we'll have two Jewish communities. One self-proclaimed and the other of the people. And they'll be radically different in spirit, in drive, and in purpose. We hope, we pray that this will not happen. The danger is there. And if we turn now from the external, the political environment in which Jews will live out the next 40 years, and turn to the internal climate, what we are as Jews, what do we find? We find that when we look back to 1933, again, the limits of possibility had to a certain degree been described. What Jews came to America? Not the Jew who wanted an intense Orthodox religious life. He had to give up that kind of life in Europe, which was the only place it existed, in order to come to these United States. Not the Jew who wanted to be part of an organized, autonomous, self-governing, pioneering Jewish community. That kind of Jew went to Palestine. The Jew who came to America wanted to come to a diaspora community which was simply more golden, more full of opportunity than the ones he was leaving behind in Europe. Most of the Jews who came to America came not because here there would be an easily developed Jewish life, full, vibrant, vigorous, but because here there was more opportunity for those who were deprived because they were labeled Jews in the old world. American Jewry, for the most part, is not made up of those who were most concerned with European Judaism. It's made up of those who were concerned with the future, who wanted often to drop the labels, who felt that they were closer as comrades than they were as chaverim. And this is true of every generation of immigration which has come to these shores. What we call now a federation was in those days an association of Jewish charities, of charities which had been for the most part created by the German Jewish immigrant wave of the 19th century, which had coalesced into an association because they wanted to avoid multiple fund drives, competing drives, which were Jewish only in the sense that voluntary social activity, the hospitals, the counseling agencies, the care agencies in America had traditionally and historically been sectarian in their sponsorship. The German Jew wanted to say, we are doing our share. And because the Protestant first and then the Catholic in America had done his share, the only way the German Jew could do his share was as a Jew. He couldn't create a, to prove his point, he couldn't create a non-sectarian hospital. So he created Mount Sinai. But he didn't create Mount Sinai for the most part because it was a Jewish hospital out of a Jewish concern. Most of those who gave large sums of money across the country to these agencies, which are now the basic agencies in our communities, did so not because they were concerned with Jewish survival, but because it didn't look good if the Jews didn't take care of their own. It did so because this was expected of rich people in these United States. And the downtown Jew, the new immigrant, took advantage of these institutions. He was glad to have them. He came from a Europe in which if the Jews didn't take care of their own, nobody else did. He didn't ask too many questions about their Jewishness, but he too was really not concerned with the impact of these institutions insofar as Jewish survival, what we call today Jewish identity, was concerned. And so we had the fact that as charity began to become community, those agencies which really deal with community, the synagogue, the educational agencies, the colleges of Jewish study, the bureaus of Jewish education, the Talmud Torahs, the Zionist organizations, which were designed to be involved with the growth of young people, particularly in their involvement in Jewish life. These were outside and to a large degree remained outside the periphery of the organizing, quote, Jewish, unquote, community, because they were not deemed to be essential to the domestic concerns, the service concerns of these bodies. And then in 1933, a strange thing happened on the way to the American future, the Depression. And the Depression forced American Jews to ask some basic questions about this whole principle of generosity, of charity, what they used to call philanthropy. The very word is a Greek word, not a Jewish word, about philanthropy. Because at the very time that they were that these philanthropic agencies were most urgently needed, their budgets were being restricted. They had less and less money to operate with during the Depression, when relief was desperately needed by tens of thousands of Jews who were out of work, not to speak of the non-Jew. In 1933, it became clear to those who were involved in Jewish philanthropy that they had better ask some very, very basic questions. Why were they in business? Was it viable for American Jews, for American Protestants, or American Catholics to assume that in the highly complex society, industrial society, which had evolved in America, with its ups and downs, with its millions of working people, that in such a society, philanthropy, the Protestant concept of charity, was sufficient to take care of basic relief? The dispensing of money, poverty monies, of what we call welfare today, of health and medical care and of the like. During the 20s, there had been a great growth of charitable relief agencies and refinement of their services. But the 20s were a time of affluence. And now the lines were long and there were bread lines. And these agencies, which had depended upon the 1% of the wealthy, suddenly found that the wealthy didn't have any more monopoly money to give. The money wasn't forthcoming. There were the people, obvious need. What does one do? How does one meet this need? The New Deal was America's answer. The concept that welfare, medical service, social service, as well as education, are essentially a public function and a public responsibility in a nation where the rights of all and the taxes of all and the duties of all are universal. There was an executive director of the Milwaukee Jewish Association of Jewish Charities in 1933 by the name of Ben Glassberg. I don't know anything else about the man except that I read a fascinating article in the Menorah Journal of 1933, a generation ago, in which he tried to analyze for his own people what he called the philanthropy bust and ask, what now? What is the viable, the meaningful rationale for an American Jewish community for the next generation, our generation? Let me read to you three paragraphs from this article. Serious as the problem of poverty is at the present, it seems likely to become more so in the future. In spite of the many improvements in public health standards and the decrease in the incidence of tuberculosis and other diseases, the life expectancy of the middle-aged man is not as high as it was a half century ago. Diseases of the heart have increased materially, as have cancer and diabetes. The alarming increase in the number of mental ailments, undoubtedly the result of the quickening tempo of modern industry, has imposed a severe drain upon private and public resources. New York State, it has been estimated, would have to build a new hospital every 2 years at a cost of $10 million, merely to take care of the net increase in the number of mental cases. 35% of the families in the care of the Jewish Social Service Association in New York City in 1926 presented problems of mental deficiency or mental diseases and neuroses, either suspected or diagnosed. It is absurd to suppose the Jewish Social Service can keep up with these developments. What can private charity, Jewish or non-Jewish, do with the problems of unemployment? The advance of technology and the sharpening of the competitive struggle promises a steady augmenting of the ranks of the unemployed. No amount of skilled casework and psychiatric social work, backed by the most generous contributions, will enable the private agencies to cope with these problems. Relief societies are beginning to realize that they cannot live up to their enthusiastic campaign slogans. They no longer pretend to relieve all distress in the community, but are beginning to talk of limiting intake, of doing their work on a selective basis, and so on. This is, of course, evading the real issue, which is whether the financial relief of Jewish dependents should not be met by the whole community, leaving the Jewish Federation free to devote its energies to purely Jewish problems. The strengthening of personal service work in Jewish families, the maintenance of Jewish educational and cultural activities, which are the first to suffer in a time of depression, the help of our unfortunate fellow Jews abroad, the upbuilding of Palestine, and the aiding of the work of agencies such as the HIAS and other national institutions. What Glassberg was suggesting 40 years ago is in effect that a Jewish community federation, reason for being, was to promote, to encourage, and to make possible Jewish survival. How have we met these standards? Obviously, one prerequisite of moving into these areas was to see to it, or help see to it, that America took on the social responsibility of relief and welfare and education and medical and nursing services and the like. There is an advocacy role which is implicit in one's removal of one's community from the dispensing role. By and large, American Jews have been among those who have led in this particular area, who have been willing to see that we must pay higher taxes and have new laws in order to create a social democracy in these United States. Obviously, under the impact of Auschwitz and Dachau and the creation of the State of Israel, American Jews have responded notably, miraculously, towards the needs of the new state, towards the relief of the displaced, their resettlement and rehabilitation. Cleveland Jewry raised more money last year for these needs, overseas needs, than did the entire United States in 1933. Our record in these areas is remarkable and augurs well for a sense of Kol Yisrael Chaverim Ze Beze, the interrelationship of the Jewish people. But can we say that we have done equally well when the problem comes to roost right back here in our own homes, with our own souls and with our own children? Have we invested ourselves, our community's substance and resource, in our educational and cultural institutions, in the Jewish home? Have we made our dinner table Jewish? Have we made our holidays the Jewish holidays? Have we made our libraries, in part, libraries of Jewish books? And here the answer is that for the last generation, there is both less and more. Among most American Jews, there has been far less Jewishness, a great deal of indifference to that which is special and parochial and just ourselves. Congregational attendance, congregational membership have tended to collapse and to fall. One attends in the Jewish community fundraising affairs, but not the cultural affairs of the Jewish community. A fascinating index of this is in this new Encyclopedia Judaica, which has just been published. You'll find some of the finest gangsters of American Jewish life, and you'll miss some of the finest scholars in American Jewish life. We have been concerned with the externals rather than with the internals, and yet at the same time, and perhaps unexpected, given the fact that most Jews who came to America were really not that involved in Jewish things. That's not what brought them here. We have seen that among a minority of Jews, there has been a true Jewish renaissance. Where 40 years ago, there are only two men teaching Judaica at American University, there are over 300 men and women teaching Judaica today. Where over 40 years ago, certainly less than 20 were taking academic courses in Judaism at the university, 50,000, it's estimated, young Jewish men and women took courses in Judaism last semester. We have new enthusiasms among the young and the not so young in terms of Jewish lifestyles. We have, for the first time, a small minority of American Jews, Native American Jews, who speak Hebrew fluently. We have, for the first time, a small minority of American Jews who are intimately and totally involved in intellectual things which are Jewish, who meet regularly for adult education, who read the truly remarkable Jewish periodicals which now exist, magazines like Judaism and the like. But their numbers are in the thousands, not in the tens of thousands. We have, for the first time in American Jewish life, a Sha'ar Yashuv, a truly saving remnant of the young and the not so young, who sing and who dance, who live in Chavurot, who make aliyah to Israel, who work there for a year or two and bring back new skills to this country, who read Jewish books, who publish in the Jewish field. In the last 40 years, American Jewry has published more first-class Jewish writing and first-class Jewish scholarship than in any other generation in our entire historical experience, bar none. But it's written and published and read by the few. And for the many, it's as if it didn't exist. It had never appeared. And that's, my friends, the question of the next generation. Are we willing, as an American Jewish community, to face up to the challenge implied in the term Jewish? We know all the problems of living in this kind of abundant and open society. Obviously, the answers of the past will not fit this new world. But obviously, too, from those of us who are intimately involved in Jewish life, we know that many of the moral positions of the past are good and valid in this time or in any other time. We know that we derive strength and encouragement and enthusiasm from our worship and from our study and from our participation. We know that one can be a satisfied Jew in 1973 and that a generation from now, Judaism will still be able to satisfy. The test will be whether or not we're willing to involve ourselves in a Judaism which cannot simply be bred up by numbers, a Judaism which simply cannot be bought by pledge cards, but a Judaism which will have to be built up by us, by our love, by our concern, by our commitment. And that Judaism, dear friends, begins at our own dining room table and in our own living room. It begins in the kind of Judaism we communicate emotionally to our children, the kind of love. The Judaism, which is a Judaism of pledge cards and dinner meetings and nothing more, is a Judaism which the young read as a Judaism of the guilt-ridden trying to make up for the fact they weren't at Dachau. And the Judaism of those who are sent to a congregation and dropped at its doors is a Judaism of hypocrites. The question is, can we find enough Jewish families to establish a viable Jewish community? And that only the future will tell. Amen.